I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my marvelous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are we today, Matt?
Better than the guy in Assassin's Creed Valhalla I met who had an axe literally sticking out of his head, and he's like, does it look bad? I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it looks bad, dude.
Maybe just a little bit there, good sir. You know,
it feels like an itch or something. Oh, dude, that's not an itch. No, that's an axe in your head.
Well, what we're going to do today is we're going to scratch some itches out there for the people in the Lore Watch community who have asked us many questions about various bits and bobs as far as the things go in the World of Warcraft as far as other games. I think most of the stuff lately has been very heavily centered on World of Warcraft because, well, we have a new expansion coming out. If you have questions for this podcast or the other podcast or the queue, make sure you get them in. We do have several Discord channels set aside for that. We do try to give our patrons a little bit of a leg up by having a Patreon supporter queue and podcast questions channel, but we do have a regular one as well. If Discord isn't your thing, you can go ahead and send them in to us at podcast@blizzardwatch.com, where Matt and I will then fight over them to see which podcast gets the glorious question answering rights for your question. And occasionally I will also scour Twitter, which actually our first one comes from today. And this is one from a name that some of you may remember. This is from Adam Holisky. Does the presence of Shadowlands make the Azeroth universe deterministic? Is free will but an orchestrated delusion that is dictated by the Jailer? This is a legitimate question from Adam.
No, I know. It's just, it's also him trying to push his Derrida philosophy junk on me. And I'll say it to you again, that, as I've said it 100 times, he's a clown, Adam. But to get to the thing, first off, the Jailer's not in charge of it. The Jailer's the one attempting to break free from it.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything, he's the one struggling. He's your Derrida hero. You know, so you should go join the Jailer and be evil, because that's what, you know, rebels against the status quo would do. Oh, man. Adam and I used to have such fights about that. But anyway, to use a more Foucaultian perspective, since the apparatus is imprisoning the Jailer as much as it's imprisoning everybody else, and the Jailer's entire thing seems to be about trying to break free from what's been ordained for him, whether it's been imposed by the first ones or from somebody else, no, it's definitely not a deterministic take where the Jailer dictates it. Absolutely not. He's the one. He's like the first guy to get stuck, and it's his thrashing around that's messing it up for everybody else. If you want to take that perspective, which I do not subscribe to, but if you were going to take that perspective, the Jailer would be just as much a prisoner as else.
Yeah. Now, although this is at the heart of it, this is a question that I think I've been asked a couple times recently on Twitter or in some private discussions, where it's the idea of the mechanism of death. To sort of expand upon it and go a little bit sideways from what Adam asked here, but it's if the mechanism of death, it being the system that was put in place, usurps the natural order, and by doing so makes it into a relatively free will less system, right? Like, so people have been asking whether or not it's something that no matter what you do, you're going to go to one of these realms and you're going to be harvested. Does that actually matter? But we don't know that everybody goes to these realms. In fact, we don't know the extent of the realms to begin with either. Like, we don't know how many realms there are. We have talked about this before, where when you're sitting in Ouroboros, you look up, you see thousands of doors. There could be thousands of Shadowlands. There could be thousands of afterlives that you could possibly participate in. And there are things that have happened in canonical lore that we don't know what the end result was. Like, I think it was Brynbrad was his name?
Yeah, Crusader Brynbrad.
Yeah, so like, he was picked up by the Naru and taken by the Light. Where does that go? Because there's nothing in Bastion about that. They don't see Naru over there yet. We know the Light's there. We know the Light can touch things in the Shadowlands, but is there a special Shadowlands for just the Light? Did that particular process circumvent whatever the normal process would have been when he was selected and taken out of it? All that to say, we don't know. We don't know enough about how things have been set up. And I think it was last week that Matt brought up this wonderful point. It might have been the week before, where we don't know enough about the first ones and how things were sort of set up. And if them doing so, if them setting up and ordering the Shadowlands as they've done, or as we've told they've done, actually circumvents the natural order of the cosmos in some way. So we don't know. I have a feeling that existential crisis and sort of line of thinking will become a very common theme throughout this expansion as we learn more about the first ones, as we learn more about the Jailer, as we learn more about what actually happens or what's supposed to happen versus what's been shoehorned in place. But it's an interesting thing, although I will say that I don't think anything circumvents the free will of you while you are alive, so not really sure. I mean, I'm not going to get in the same fights that or arguments that you had with Rossi there, Adam, but I'm not exactly sure that I buy into the whole deterministic society or you know.
I think there's definitely a case to be made for an attempt at a deterministic worldview here, because you've got the Arbiter just deciding, you know, I know better than anything where you belong, and just putting you there. I mean, and then you just, either you accept it or you get stuck in the maw eventually. So, yeah, there's an element of that, certainly. But I think the entire premise of this expansion is one of both Sylvanas and the Jailer in their own ways are rebelling against the quote-unquote order of things. And that order is falling apart. We see it as we go through the various zones in the Shadowlands. The order has been disrupted, and oddly enough, it kind of harkens back to an old quest in Vanilla called Order Must Be Restored. And ironically, in that quest, you killed Nathanos Maris to restore order, because Nathanos was disrupting the order of things. It was a very jaundiced viewpoint. And we're going to talk about Nathanos more, I believe, right? There's a question with
him? There at least one more coming up with Nathanos in it.
So I'll reserve my statements for that, but I definitely think it's interesting to see how Shadowlands takes that concept of life, death, and the order of things, and the ordering of things, and how it presents ways of disrupting it, ways it has been disrupted, ways people want to disrupt it. So I think that's pretty cool.
Our next question comes from Snowbeard. Question for Lorewatch. Wow, I can't talk today. Sorry, folks. What's actually happening when we corpse run, and how, if at all, does it relate to the Shadowlands? And is it just a known concept that our characters never really die? Like, does someone in the group look at a dead party member and think, oh, it's okay, she'll be back? And how come we get to corpse run, but main characters like Garrosh get sent to the Shadowlands? I realize there may not be a good lore reason, and this is simply just a game mechanic that we need to look past. Thanks for everything you guys do.
There is a lore reason, actually, and it's pretty interesting. Part of Shadowlands is all about why your character doesn't stay dead. There's this underlying storyline that involves what's going on there, why you keep getting, like, think of it, the way to think of it is normally when someone dies, they go into the Shadowlands, they're found by one of the Kyrian, and they're sort of shepherded to the Arbiter to be sent to their proper afterlife. The spirit healer you keep running into is like a Kyrian that is not, it's sort of like sliding you back over instead of letting you come fully through to be taken to the Arbiter. When you die, you're kind of bouncing off death. Think of it like a spacecraft that's trying to enter an atmosphere, but it's trying to go in too directly. It will burn up. If it tries to go in at an angle, it can bounce off the atmosphere. That's what we're doing with the Shadowlands. And that spirit healer has been very deliberately helping you. Because you have a destiny.
Yeah, what is it? What is it they say that...
Well, go ahead. What you were saying?
I was going to say, what is it that they said? It was like spirit healers are Kyrian watchers that if a soul's not ready, they return them to life. I think that was like the old statement of it or something like that.
That was back when that's two BlizzCons ago. Well, not yeah. two BlizzCons. The BlizzCon that we had in 2019. That was something like that was said. So it's, and there's more to it. Like as you go through the various zones, it gets touched upon again, but not going to spoil too much for you. I'll just say that that is definitely part of the story. As for... Generally speaking, people don't do that. Like, if you read, there's a story a few years back during Cataclysm that starred Anduin and Varian Wrynn. And Anduin, when he healed... Varian dies in the story, and Anduin heals him. And they don't know if Anduin actually brought him back from death or not. Like, they're very... I don't know how... You know, maybe he was just mostly dead. That they're... It's a very hard call. Like, people... When a healer, like, heals somebody... When you resurrect somebody, it doesn't necessarily turn out to be resurrection. Now, if you did the Blood Knight starting zone, like not Blood Knight starting zone, if you were a Blood Elf and you played a Blood Knight, a Paladin, originally there was a quest where you took light from the Naru and you went out and found a dead Paladin and you raised him with it. And in that case, everybody knew that was a resurrection spell. Everybody knew you brought that guy back from the dead. So there's lore in the game and in the world for both.
Yeah, and I find it kind of funny because, like, didn't we just have this with Legion with the whole Illidan thing and the whole, like, immortal soul and all that other stuff?
Immortal demon soul.
But, like, it's an interesting concept of, like, and I've been thinking about it. If you have a destiny, if that is sort of like what's going on here, Illidan had a destiny. He wasn't allowed to die. Maybe that plays more into it than actually having a quote unquote immortal soul.
Nope, it's immortal demon soul. Not buying this. Dude, he said it to me in a thing when I was playing my demon.
Yes, because he's 100% fully trustworthy.
Like, yes, he totally is. He's my guy. He's my boo. You be quiet now.
Illidan, please trust me, Bay Stormrage, of course. But no, it's this interesting concept of like, is it because we have a destiny or is there something else going on? And like Matt pointed out, we're going to be learning more about that as we progress through Shadowlands. There's a whole that is one of the central points of the expansion coming up is why don't we actually die? Like why can we corpse run? Why can we go back? And it's interesting to see how it evolves because back when this question was asked, I want to say like 2008, there was a wonderful BlizzCon question that got asked by a certain now lore-focused folk that asked, you know, that very question, why can't we die? Why are we special? Why are other people, you know, why do NPCs die but we can't? Why? What's the deal with that?
I also think there is something to be said for circumstances. Like, it seems to be a lot of times that when you come back from the dead, there's a little bit of wiggle room. Whereas people who get obliterated into, like, you know, chunks or dust, like Varian didn't come back the second time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he got literally blown up with fell power, I don't even know what happened to his soul. It's quite possible it was destroyed.
Yeah, we have no clue because we haven't seen him. And
so, yeah, I do think there's a little bit of wiggle room, but there's lore for both possibilities. There's lore for people know that resurrection magic exists and works, and there's lore for maybe he was dead, maybe I just got him before he died. So,
yep. I mean, and we will find out more. And I think they're like Matt said, there's a little bit of wiggle room so they can decide how that sort of works out if they really, really need to. Our next question comes from Rhineblade. Question for Lorewatch. How do we make sense of Sylvanas' interaction with Balnazar, Deatharok, and Verimothris, assuming enemy infiltration is written by a Dreadlord, meaning all of them are agents of death after all?
Do you know what deep cover is? I'm serious. I'm not being sarcastic here. A deep cover operative is somebody who is so deeply inserted into another group's hierarchy that they function as if they are a member of that hierarchy, sometimes going months or years without breaking cover.
Or lifetimes, yeah.
If you've seen the TV show The Americans, that kind of thing is what I'm talking about, where they're Soviet agents, but they look and act like Americans to the point where their day-to-day life is completely the same as anyone around them. If Enemy Infiltration was written by a Dreadlord, and if we take it, therefore, that the Dreadlords secretly work for Sire Deathrock, not Deathrock, what is his name?
Denathrius.
Deathrock. Sorry, guys. But if we take those two things as facts, then they wouldn't break cover for somebody who is not currently in the service of the Jailer. When they meet Sylvanas, she's working for Arthas, who is working for the Lich King, who is not currently serving either the Legion or the Jailer, as far as they can tell.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason that they would break cover. And that was years ago. So now, keep in mind that even if we assume that they were working for the, you know, Denathrius and thus the Jailer back then, if anything, she was a threat to them. She wasn't on board. In fact, the entirety of the past several years may have been turning Sylvanas into a weapon for the Jailer to neutralize the threat she posed. If you think about it, that's actually entirely possible. They used her to help them get rid of the Lich King, and once the Lich King was out of the way and wasn't a threat anymore, and the new Lich King didn't know what was going on, they could then subvert Sylvanas. And I say they, I don't mean the Dreadlords, I literally mean the Jailer and Denathrius and the others who work for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's no reason they would have said or done anything differently than they did. They were in deep cover. They were in the Legion. They were doing the Legion's bidding because they didn't want to be seen doing anything else. And the last thing they needed... I mean, keep in mind, too, the whole reason that the Lich King even existed might have been the Dreadlords. Because we don't know where Kil'jaeden got that helm and sword and armor from. We just know that the Dreadlords seem to be involved in it. So there's a lot to this, but I definitely think you can't just assume just because... You know, they're all on the same side now, possibly, and we don't even know that that's true. We don't actually know that the Dreadlords are working for Denathrius. We have one thing that seems to point that way. That doesn't mean it's the case. It's not canon yet. But even if that was true, that they were secretly working for the Jailer all this time, Sylvanas wasn't.
Yeah,
Sylvanas didn't even know he existed.
Yeah, and I mean, even we're also making the assumption, I guess, in some of the stuff that started happening, Wrath of the Lich King, end of Wrath of the Lich King, that people are like, oh, she very clearly, you know, saw the Jailer and made a deal then. We don't know that. We don't know when the deal was made. Like, I've put forward the idea that the deal wasn't made then. The deal was made after she was shown nothing but despair, darkness, and emptiness awaiting her. Like, it's all this, I think it's all been a long game to get her maneuvered into a position where, like Matt said, she becomes a weapon for them as opposed to against them.
Also the possibility that I don't want to, interrupt Joe here, but it's me. There's also the possibility that Sylvanas is playing her own game at the same time.
Absolutely. Because she is very... very good at playing the long game as well. And it's also something that we don't know what she has gleaned from her interactions with these three over the years. We don't know where she really is standing. She's doing things already that we know that they were not anticipating, such as instead of using the power of the Helm of Domination to shattering the Helm of Domination, which... it seems to be pretty heavily hinted at that it was not the original intent for anyone for her to do that. It is entirely possible that she's running on her own and doing her own things under the guise, again, of deep cover, like Matt just explained, but going the opposite direction. Not saying that it makes any of her actions right. I'm not trying to be a Sylvanas apologist or anything like that. But it's something to bear in mind that there may be more going on than we realize. But if you look at her past interactions with, you know, any of the Dreadlords, it all seems like it's been subtle pushes and redirection to get her where she needed to be. And that seems to be exactly what they do. Anytime we've seen a Dreadlord ingrained in any of the societies or organizations or anything on Azeroth, what are they doing? They are subtly pushing those groups, those people, those individuals towards a different thing. I mean, look at the Scarlet Crusade. Look at all of everything that's happened with all that. It started as such a noble thing, and then it all of a sudden a Dreadlord gets in, and next thing you know, they're even more fanatical than they were before, and it gets worse and worse and worse with just these simple light little nudges in that direction. That's what Dreadlords do. They're not overt. They play long games. They have eons of plans and subtle moves on the table, right? So, again, they could have been trying to maneuver her. She could have figured that out. She's not dumb. She could be swinging back in her own way, playing that game just as well. But who knows? And again, like Matt said, we only have that one piece of evidence from Shadowlands right now that links the Nathrezim to being agents of death under Sire Denathrius. It is possible that that is the truth of it. It's also possible that that's another misdirect as well. There's a lot we don't know about, and we haven't even scratched the surface in Shadowlands of how the Dreadlords fit into that. We just know that at one point in time, they were in the Shadowlands. All right. Our next question comes from a rather large radioactive lizard, Godzilla. Not to be a Nathanos apologist, but when Lothamar called Nathanos Maris a bully and braggart in life, it didn't sit completely right with me and almost came off as hypocritical. Yes, Nathanos was a grumpy and not very pleasant person in life, but it's not like the High Elves seemed to treat him with any form of dignity or respect during his time with them. I'm sure Nathanos didn't do himself any favors during his time in Silvermoon with his infamous sunny disposition, but at the same time, it feels like Lothamar, Haldoran, and the others were openly question his placement amongst them, despite Nathanos' apparent skill. We've all tried to succeed in environments that were cold and unwelcoming, so I'm not going to fault living Nathanos for being a sour guy. Forsaken Nathanos, well, that's a whole other story. Anywho, I wanted to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think Lothamar was having a moment of the pot calling the kettle black against the old comrade rival he torment? Or has the actions his unlife as the Blightcaller wiped any sympathies for the ranger formerly known as Nathanos Maris? Regardless, I'm sure the Maris stead was only a setback.
I mean, I'll be up front here. I don't mind seeing Nathanos get chopped up into small pieces and those pieces scattered somewhere so that even if he does go to the mall, he can't come back. Like, I got no problem with Nathanos dying hard. But that being said, you're right that Lothamar and the other members of that of the Farstriders were gigantic, colossal, throbbing members to Nathanos at every single opportunity. And it was purely out of jealousy. And not even jealousy out of the fact that he was hooking up with Sylvanas. Before that, they were jealous of him because he was a better shot than them. Like it or not, Nathanos Maris is probably the third or fourth best archer in Azeroth.
Yep.
I'd put Taranda, Taranda, Sylvanas, then Chandris, because Chandris is the best. Chandris is better than Sylvanas, who's better than it. But those three are probably it in terms of being better than Nathanos. And it's telling that Taranda shot him before they got into the fight.
Hold on a second. I don't know if you saw the tweet about that, but apparently the team noted that her absence of a bow in that thing, the question was asked if she just threw the arrow at him, and their only response was yeet.
Well, you know, either way, it's telling that she did. It was an arrow she used to defeat him, but it's still absolutely fair to say that Lothamar was always jealous of Nathanos, and living Nathanos had done nothing to really deserve it other than be a bit of a tool, but he was being a bit of a tool to people who were flat out blatantly racist to him. And it's kind of hard for me to blame him for how he treated them. The idea that Nathanos was grumpy at the Farstriders. Yeah, you join a group and every single person in it, except one, treats you like you're inferior because of where you were born, even though you're better than they are at the thing you're supposed to be doing. Yeah, no, they were jerks. There's no other way to say this. There's no way to dress it up. Lothamar and Haldoran and all of them, up to and including Kael'thas, who tried to get him bounced out of the Farstriders for being human. So I don't sympathize with him in the slightest. I loathe Nathanos Maris. But your point is very valid. That's absolutely the case. It doesn't excuse anything he's done since, but it's absolutely true.
So this is one of those things where I think Lothamar was right and wrong at the same time. So I think that one of the statements that he made is pretty much accurate, that who you are in life seems to be amplified to some degree in unlife. And I think if we look at it through everything that happened with the the Dark Shore Warfront with all of those wardens that got raised and the Night Elves that got raised. Their last moments were consumed by rage, pain, and doubt. When they're resurrected, that becomes the all-consuming aspect of their personality. We see this in Shadows Rising. We see this in all of our interactions with them in game. It's they remember the hatred. They remember the pain. I think it was you that pointed out, and I can't remember her name now, where it's like almost like she needs to kill to feel okay.
Oh, Sierra Moonwarden.
Yeah, Sierra Moonwarden.
It's actually very similar to the Death Knight thing.
Yeah, very much so. And I find that fascinating because then this question made me start thinking about that in terms of Nathanos. And what Matt's saying, I think, is right. Nathanos was reacting to a life where he had these moments of happiness, this person who loved him and saw him for who he was, amongst a society of people that hated him for his skill, his passion, and for where he was born. And again, I'm not excusing anything he's done, but I could see where Nathanos in this moment, his last moments of life, if that is such a huge part of what he dealt with for so long, it becoming so amplified in his unlife. Because if you look at it, like, in life he had to be calm and cool and collected. He had to have that sunny disposition. He had to be,
to be fair, he did not have a sunny disposition.
I'm quoting, like, air quotes, like, the sunny disposition thing where, like, yes, he was a jerk, but he was smarmy jerk. He wasn't, like, you know, the kid with the slick back hair and the switchblade. It was the, I'm better than you and I know it. He lorded that over them whenever he could to sort of drive the blade in. And then you look at...
because ultimately, when they would go, you know, he was a better archer. And
yeah.
They couldn't touch him.
And if you look at his personality after he's been resurrected, after he returned to, you know, Sylvanas' side, after he was given back his gift of thought, released from whatever the being trapped in the Scourge body was, these are all things that were amplified. These are things that if you ask a player what they hate about Nathanos, one of the first things that comes up is how smarmy he is. But that's who he was in life because that's who he had to be. And I'm wondering if it's just another case of those last emotions, those things that were so core to his being are getting amplified, but Lothamar is projecting the bullying. And braggart. Like, the braggart part I could kind of see because he was smarmy and would show that he was better than them at every chance he got. But it was a reaction to, you're not good enough to be here. You're just a human. You don't deserve to be here. You know, classic fantasy racism, right? So I'm wondering if maybe that plays into it in his own life where, because his last years of life, that's what was so core, so ever-present, even as he died, like... Is that why he hates the living so much? Is that why he hates in particular the elves so much? Because he hates the elves. Oh boy, he hates the... is that why he's so smarmy? Like, it's smarmy turned up to 11. He's basically... why can't I think of his name? There was an old movie called PCU, and one of the comedians, I can't remember his name.
I can't help you with this. I've not seen this movie.
But he was a real small guy. He did all the movies with, like, Chris Farley and that. David Spade. David Spade plays the smarmiest character I have ever seen in my entire life, and the Thanos makes him look friendly. It's not a bad thing as far as characterization goes, but it is interesting to note that those are his traits that get turned up, that get amplified. And even Sylvanas, like in her undeath, in her unlife, or whatever you want to call it, her aspects of cold, calculating, being that general, she's trying to latch onto that. Even when she starts to feel emotions, she tries to tamper it down, but it's still that hatred, that calculating nature is just turned up to like such a weird degree that it's almost like when they're resurrected, when they're brought back into these bodies, they're not fully themselves anymore. They're a shade of their former selves, and it's whatever the last vestiges of their life were, that's what makes up the bulk of their personality. That's what's rebuilt into it. So who knows, but I would agree with Matt that I think I could understand in life why Nathanos was the way he was, but I don't apologize or make excuse for anything he did in his... All right, anything else to add to that before we move on to our next one?
Just that it's kind of rich for anybody, for Lothamar of anybody, to complain that somebody else isn't friendly and welcoming.
Oh yeah, no, seriously. What was that happened with the Void Elves and everything else?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when, you know, before the Void Elves even, the High Elves tried to come back to look at the Sunwell, and, you know, if you brought in the Quel'Thalar and you weren't a Blood Elf, then they basically tossed your ass at a curb super fast. So, yeah.
Yep.
Not a welcoming bunch, Lorthamar and Haldoran. Not the friendliest people.
For a group of people that complain about not being accepted. Yeah, go figure. Our next question. My question is, why don't the orcs speak in their own language more often? Or are we simply hearing English for the sake of the players, and they are actually speaking orcish all along? All I hear from them is, Loktarugar! Thanks for the insight. Sparta, a Blood Elf demon hunter.
It's probably fair to assume that they speak orc to each other a lot more. Some people make the point that the common tongue of the Horde is probably, I mean, what else would they be? It's not like they're going to be speaking human or the various human, which is, I guess, Lordaeronian. I don't know. But yeah, it's probably fair to assume that if it's Thrall and I can't remember his name.
Eitrig.
Thank you. Eitrig. Yeah. If it's Thrall and Eitrig, just chatting, they're probably talking. It would be difficult if everybody had their native language filter on all the time, because like if you're playing a Forsaken, you don't speak Orcish. Which is weird. You'd think it would be the common tongue of the Horde, but yeah, since your Forsaken doesn't speak Orcish, you would have no idea half of the things Thrall was saying, and you'd have to have somebody there translating for you. It'd be weird, and I think that's generally it is.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree, and it's also really fascinating, because I remember back during the early days of the game where players would flip over from common to whatever the player race language was when interacting in raids or trying to keep things private or whatever, just because for whatever reason, and this is anecdotal, but I know like my friends, like a bunch of us would play Tauren, like, and so we would have our own little language. And so during raids, if we wanted to like talk but not talk with everybody else, we'd flip over from, you know, common to our racial language. But I would imagine that most of what we see is basically game mechanics, and that's why everything is filtered down into whatever the common language of the Horde is. But I do think that it would make sense as far as like society wise. Like if you're in Thunderbluff, you're probably not going to hear a whole lot of Orcish. If you are in the Echo Isles, you're probably not going to hear a lot of, you know, Tauren language at all. Like it's probably one of those things where in private matters they would speak their own language.
I just imagine a bunch of there being like a language club on the Echo Isles and a bunch of trolls learning Tauren, and it's just, it turns out it's really hard to pronounce Tauren words with giant tusks coming out of your mouth.
So what you're saying is one of the hidden Loa is Duolingo?
I just, yeah, basically. But it's like it's like, you know, the Tauren hear him talking, it's like, my God, your accent. What's wrong with my accent? Like, what are you doing? It sounds like you're swallowing a watermelon over there. I'm like, look, you thought I talked with these big things coming out of my mouth. Why do you think we talked like this? And just, you know, going from there. I hope I just wasn't really insensitive. If I was, I apologize. It occurred to me halfway through that someone with a speech impediment might not think that was funny, and then I feel bad now. But nevertheless, I think that trolls speaking Tauren amuses me. Yeah, it just happened.
Yeah, so we're gonna move past that, but yeah, I think it's safe to assume that your races of Azeroth speak their own language among their own people probably pretty frequently. And as somebody who is from a multicultural background with growing up speaking multiple languages, I can tell you that it's kind of called code switching, like it, but it's like,
yeah. Haven't you talked about that? Sometimes you'll be speaking and yeah, you switch when you aren't really thinking about it.
Yeah. So like, and it's very, and I would have, in my mind, and I don't know if this is accurate and Blizzard can tell me I'm wrong, but I would think that it's almost like that. Cause like when I was with my, you know, Puerto Rican family, slipping into Spanish was second nature. When I was with my Italian family, switching into Italian was, you know, second nature, even though it's not my primary language. It's just because you go into that mode and your brain just starts making the necessary connections, the switch. And if you think about it, your characters in Azeroth are all multilingual, for the most part, with, I think, the exception of humans. I think humans don't speak a second language, which is weird, canonically, but it's, I would see that it's probably something similar for them where, you know, when dwarves are hanging out with dwarves, they're probably speaking dwarvish without even thinking about it. But when they start dealing with humans, they start having to switch back into common, even if it's not 100% common all of the time. So you know, I think the races of Azeroth code switch when necessary. Our next question, quick and simple one. We all know that Sylvanas does not deserve a redemption arc and that she needs punishment. Personally, I cannot see a better punishment for her than to serve as a Valkyr ferrying souls for all eternity. For all her struggles from freedom of servitude, what could be more fitting? And I can hear you people saying already, that's a noble service of the Kyrian. It shouldn't be punishment. Except to ascend, they forget their past lives. Clearly, Sylvanas would be forced to retain. Azamoth, Night Fallen Elf of Area 50. I don't like this.
Oh, the idea that, you know, if somebody has done horrible things because they were upset or afraid to be enslaved, that the proper purpose is to make them a slave.
Yeah, this is too much like punishing a victim by making them a victim again.
And it's not, you know, I don't have even the slightest bit of sympathy for Sylvanas Winterrun. It comes down to what are you doing? If you're the kind of person that does that, then you've confirmed every negative stereotype anyone ever had about you. It's not a question of, sometimes you don't do an awful thing not for the person that you don't do the awful thing to, but for everybody else who's watching. You know, it's not a question of, do they deserve it? It's a question of, what do you deserve?
Yeah, like, there's,
I don't
always
want to be, I'm not a slaver. I'm not going to make someone a slave.
Yeah.
The Kyrian, I have serious problems with the Kyrian. Like, I'm not on board with their way of doing things. I feel like that, you know, I don't, the whole thing about ferrying souls, that doesn't really bug me. But the thing where they strip you of your identity, that definitely does. That needs to go.
Strip you of your identity and knowledge in order to serve. Like,
yeah, I am not on board with the Kyrian approach, even when it's applied to anybody, much less Sylvanas. And I get you're saying that Sylvanas wouldn't be stripped of identity. This is bad. If it's a thing you want to be doing, if it's a good thing that people should do, putting someone in charge who's going to spend her entire time doing it, trying to come up with a way out of it, and who has proved she's very good at coming up with ways out of things? No, this is just, it's a terrible idea from stem to stern.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, again, I just have this thing in my brain where I'm, you don't do that to people. We're supposed to be heroes of this world. And it's not saying that we don't do questionable things. We do all the time. We have a very short-sighted view of how the world works as far as threats and long-term effects. I will never, ever say that we don't. But for us to put somebody in that type of position to punish them with the thing that broke them in the first place is not okay. It's not okay in any sense of the word. I don't care how horrible a person is. You don't do that. And it's one of those things where, like, even the worst of the worst of Azeroth, like, we have a prison for demons. We literally have a prison in the middle of a mage city for demons. Do you think we could have figured out something worse to do with them? Yeah. Should we have? Probably not.
Well, it comes, like, one of the things this makes me think of, and it's not a perfect lineup. There's a writer named Terry Pratchett, wrote the Discworld books. One of the books he has is a character named Sam Vimes, who at one point finds himself in a bad situation, and he says, if you're ever looking down the barrel and someone's got you dead to rights, pray that it's an evil person, because they're going to get off on it. They're going to want to gloat. They're going to want to keep you in their power. A good person is just going to kill you because they've decided you have to be killed, and they're going to do it and move on. And they're not going to spend a second gloating about it, and they're not going to think about it because they've already done all the agonizing. If they've already got you like that, then that they've made the decision. That should be how we are with Sylvanas. You should have already gone through whatever you need to go through thought-wise to get to the right situation, and you should just do it. And it shouldn't be, we need a fitting punishment. No. The thing people keep going for, the idea of a punishment that fits what you did, punishment isn't about fitting what you did. It's either about justice for the people who suffered, or it's about redemption and
rehabilitation. Yep.
And if we're not going to try to rehabilitate Sylvanas because she's too far gone, then this is only about justice for the victims. There's nothing about justice in doing what you're suggesting. It doesn't come close to the thousands upon thousands who have died at her hands. So when you can't redress the scales, it's best to just make an end of it. Just end it. So, yeah, no, I'm not down for, now you are a slave forever. Ha ha ha. See how you failed to get away. Like, what am I? Am I the Lich King now? The Lich King does that kind of things. Arthas does that kind of things. I'm not those guys. That's I don't want to be involved.
Yeah. No, same. And again, we can understand that people want that, regardless of how you feel about Sylvanas, you either feel very strongly connected to her or against her, and you want some form of retribution, those that are against her, for what she's done and the tragedy she's you know, perpetrated. I get that. But let us not become the same monster that she has
been. That's like, I mean, I'm sitting here totally. I have no sympathy for Sylvanas. I don't like Sylvanas. I've never liked Sylvanas. I like Sylvanas as a character who does really interesting things in a story. But she is the villain to me, and mm-hmm. she always has been. But that being said, I don't know. I feel like a lot of times people don't. There's a lot of nuance to this that I don't think people get. That you can think a character is malevolent inside the story, like them inside the story, but also want them to get like a proper fate. I want closure to all of this. I want it to end and us to move past it. So yeah, no, I'm not down for that.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to our next one. This is a bit of a long one. This one comes from Bradford. Questions for Lorewatch. I've been hoarding these for a while, so feel free to pick and choose what to answer. And I apologize if these have been answered at a past time. Well, if they were, we'll let you know. What was Illidan doing in Outland that required us to go take him out? If the Light knew that he was destined to be a hero, why did Adal let us go try to kill him?
Can we like break these up and answer them separately?
Yeah.
Okay, because I wanted to answer this one really fast.
I know.
Adal was not talking to Zira. They'd been separated for untold thousands of years. Zira took like the Draenei that wanted to go fight an eternal war, and she went off to fight an eternal war, while Adal took the Draenei, like the civilians, the majority of their population, and ran with them. So the two were not in contact. That's take one. Take two, Zira didn't really know exactly what she was doing with Illidan. Like, she didn't know where he was, or, you know, it took her a while to find him.
Oh, yeah.
That's number two. Number three, Illidan was setting up a mass sacrifice that was horrific. Yes, he was fighting the Legion, but he was very much the kind of guy who thinks, all right, I need to win this war, so it's acceptable for me to kill thousands of people who are on my side, as long as millions of people will survive because of what I did. Illidan is an ends justify the means kind of guy. And yeah. he attacked Shattrath. He sent forces to attack Adal and the Naru that were there. So he started it. They were fighting back. As to what we were doing there, we went there because we knew that the Legion was going to come through that portal and attack our world. We were attempting a preemptive strike. Once we got there, Illidan and his Illidari were the ones attacking us, just as much as the Legion. When you go to Hellfire Peninsula in Burning Crusade, there's Illidari taskmasters enslaving like the broken right there.
Yep.
Just as much as the actual Legion. The Illidari are there and they're not being friendly. They're attacking. So Illidan sort of set himself up as like, I can't work with anybody. It's pretty clear that he was kind of spiraling. Like every run-in you see with him, sure he had a plan and sure he was executing it, but he was also being paranoid and delusional, and he knew what Kael'thas was doing. And didn't do anything about it. There's Illidan was kind of, if you read the Illidan novel, he was very monofocused and he was kind of off the rails.
I was just going to say, like, if you really want a really good long form answer to your question, read the Illidan novel. It will give you a whole lot of insight into why we absolutely had to do what we had to do. It is a great source of information for you. But yeah, everything that Matt said is accurate. I don't disagree with any of it. The next question from this. If our characters are the only things able to escape the Maw, how did the Helm of Domination and Frostmourne get out? If I recall from hearing somewhere, the Maw is where they were created. Someone, I'm assuming the Dreadlocks, I'm guessing he means Dreadlord, had to get them. So we don't know where they were created. We don't know specifically what forge they were created in. We knew that they were created in the same manner as the rune weaponry and soulbind items that we've seen in Maldraxxus, but also in Torghast, where the rune carver is. As far as
the implication is that it's the Forge of Domination that's atop Torghast, but we don't know for sure yet.
Right. Now, as far as how they escaped the Maw, who knows? we could possibly be the Dreadlords. The Dreadlords may have had a hand in that, which is how they got to the Legion in the first place. But we're going to find out more about that as the expansion rolls on. We do know that they are incredibly important pieces to the puzzle. As a matter of fact, as Matt has pointed out many times, you use the fragments of the Helm of Domination to dominate spirits in the Maw and make them do what you need them to do. And there's a lot of stuff about specifically like runic weaponry and items of that nature throughout all of Maldraxxus and throughout Torghast and other places. So we'll find out more, but we don't know the specifics on how they escaped from Shadowlands in general. But the assumption is that the Dreadlords had something to do with it. Anything to add to that one?
No, I think it's generally that you got it.
All right, cool. Next one. Relating to the Lich King and his sword, because of Bolvar, we know that the Lich King doesn't need Frostmourne to function. So why did the Legion put both the helm and the sword in the Frozen Throne? If I remember Warcraft 3 correctly, they only needed the Lich King to control the Scourge enough to summon Archimonde. But Frostmourne being thrust out is what results in the Lich King freeing himself, which I don't remember being part of the Legion's plan. Should I assume this was part of the Dreadlord's plan, being servants of the Jailer this whole time, or did they steal the helm and sword not knowing exactly how it worked and thought both were needed?
We don't know the answer to this question is the most basic answer. I'm going to say, and then I think Joe has some other stuff to throw in that will help elucidate, but we don't actually know that the Lich King worked fine without Frostmourne. He had to spend like several years sitting up top there, and when Sylvanas came calling, he couldn't stop her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he'd had Frostmourne, would he have been able to stop her? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll bet he would have had a better chance than just some old magic hammer that he had made for himself. Arthas did some crazy stuff with that sword. You'll notice that Arthas raised Sindragosa with Frostmourne, and the runes on Frostmourne were what panicked. What was Uther's Kyrian mentor? I can't remember her name. Devos?
I think that's the main one. I can't remember the name, but yeah,
when she saw the runes on Frostmourne, that's what freaked her out. Frostmourne is definitely important. In terms of whether it was the Dreadlord's plan, it does seem... You'll notice the Dreadlords went through a great deal of trouble to get Arthas to pick up Frostmourne. And that was part of the whole plan from the beginning, was to get Arthas to pick up Frostmourne so that he'd become a servant of the Lich King, and thus they could use him to accomplish their aims. So it definitely feels like Frostmourne was very much a part of the whole plan.
Yeah, I think it's part and parcel to it. Honestly, the other thing to really note is that, like Matt said, the sword was integral to a lot of things the Lich King did. Every time he created a Valkyr, he used the sword. We witnessed it. We legitimately witnessed the birth of one of his Valkyr, but at his hand in an instance. He raised Sindragosa and the other Frostworms, raised liches with it in order to continue the work, used it.
The original Saffron?
Yeah.
Was raised using Frostmourne because Arthas didn't have the Helm of Dominate. He did it.
Yep.
He wasn't the Lich King yet. So everything he did as Arthas, not as the Lich King, but as Arthas the Death Knight, he did with Frostmourne.
And part of the Ice Crown Citadel creation was done through Frostmourne as well. Not all of it, because it was reinforced and built up with Serenite, but like when we start talking about where the Frozen Throne was located, how the mountain around it was shaped, all of that stuff, that was the Lich King acting through the power of Frostmourne. So it's important. We don't know the extent of it. We don't know what the plan was, but it is important, at least in some part, to the functionality of the Lich King. Not only that, but it's also one of those things where, trying to think of how to phrase it. There's a level of import for the time that Bolvar didn't have it and the fact that he wasn't as corrupted or taken fully as he was. So there's something to consider there. Anything else to add to that one?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we could go back and forth on how involved Frostmourne was in the creation of Ice Crown, because the original Ice Crown was created when they threw the actual Frozen Throne onto our world, and then they threw it into Ice Crown Glacier, and the Ice Crown Citadel was originally just a big spire, because when he cracked open the Lich King's the Frozen Throne with the sword. That's all he did with the sword. The rest was when he put the helmet on, the big explosion happened, and there was spire. And then, of course, they mired up. But none of this is really that important for what we're discussing. Frostmourne is definitely an item of importance. But we don't know exactly. For that matter, we don't know We know that when a rune weapon is reforged, it becomes more powerful. We know that Frostmourne was made into two weapons, and we don't know after the events of Legion what happened to them. Technically, I guess your Death Knight's got them in the bank, but I mean, your Shadow Priest probably had Xalatath in the bank, and yet it was running around doing stuff. So who knows?
Yeah. And then I think we have one last part of the questions from our friend here. Other than the Tears of Alun, do we have anything else connecting Thanaru to Alun? Alun has been part of Azeroth for all of its known history, and if Alun created the Naru, seems like they would have shown up during the War of the Ancients when the Legion invaded, since Alun would know the importance of protecting Azeroth, but the Naru only appeared with the Draenei, even though they have existed out in the cosmos for 25,000 years or so. My point is, because something is named the whatever of whoever doesn't mean that it is what it is. The Tears may not be related to Alun. The Eye of Sargeras wasn't really his eye, for example. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, the Eye of Sargeras was named because it was used by the Avatar of Sargeras. It was a device that it used in its whatever it was doing in Northrend. So it wasn't, it might have been the eye of the Avatar. But if you look at the Avatar of Sargeras, when the Fallen Avatar, when we go fight it, it has both of its eyes. So it could have just been some kind of device. But I mean, for that matter, the Jeweled Scepter of Sargeras, which your warlock might have had, it's, you know, it's one of the three artifacts they get, the Scepter of Sargeras. That was a scepter that belonged to Sargeras. It doesn't, in this case, it's not a good example. These are items that belong to Sargeras. So does that mean that the Tear of Alun had nothing to do with Alun? It seems unlikely, because the High Priestess of Alun didn't seem to have a problem with it, like seemed to view it as an artifact related to Alun.
Yeah,
and we know that Alun, it doesn't just exist on Azeroth, because we know in Shadowlands we will meet a Night Warrior, one of the first Night Warriors known, who served Alun on another world. So if the Naru were out there in the cosmos, yeah, it's unfortunate that this world that Alun has worshippers on is getting invaded, but worlds are getting invaded everywhere. You know what I mean? Like, They might have been busy. It's a big universe, and there are not an infinite amount of Naru in it. Just because Alun is important to Azeroth and finds Alun might very well think Azeroth is important, she's got worshippers there, doesn't mean she can just ignore the whole universe because one world gets invaded by the Legion. We don't know how that works. There's a lot we don't know, so we're kind of blue sky here. But it's definitely not necessarily the case that just because, even if Alun did make the Naru, and I'm not saying that she did, but even if Alun did make the Naru, it doesn't mean the Naru would just go wherever Alun tells him to. I've never seen a Naru mention Alun. Have you, Joe?
No, I don't think I have either. Like, the Naru haven't really said anything to do with Alun. Like, they've talked about the light, and a lot of the stuff we make that correlation, where a lot of it is us making that correlation, right? We're the ones making that connection between the two.
It was a weird book that Khadgar found that suggested there might be some sort of relationship between, and that's why he said, you know, try the Tear of Alun. Just because the Tear of Alun worked doesn't mean it worked because there's a direct connection. It could have just been that Alun is a powerful being with, you know, access to the holy light, and the Naru needed that kind of power to reactivate. We don't know.
Yeah. So and it's entirely possible that the Tears of Alun is not related to Alun, that we're making that correlation as players, that we're making that correlation as player characters, but we don't know yet. We're probably going to find out more of that, especially with, we know the involvement of Ysera in Shadowlands. There's always going to be this thing where we're going to find more, I don't want to say like linkage, we're going to find more presence, more linkage between, you know, the light, Alun, and what's going on with everything, because that's sort of part and parcel. We know that the light is important to what's happening in Bastion. It has something to do with what's going on in Revendreth. We know that the presence of Alun is something that is felt there because the Night Warrior is an Ardenweald. Ysera is an Ardenweald. We're going to find out a whole lot more. It's just a matter of, you know, the specifics about it. Is it possible that the Tears of Alun is just something that has been credited to her? No, I don't, it is possible, but like Matt pointed out, I think the priestesses who are sort of in tune with Alun would kind of get the resonance, right? Like, that's one of the things that magic sort of has a feel to it in Azeroth. And you hear this in various books, the stories, interactions with NPCs. They can feel wrongness in magic. They can feel if it's arcane. They can feel sort of the shamanistic magic of it. They talk about how magic feels. And so, like, I would think that if it wasn't part of Ilun, that I think that the priestesses of Ilun would know. I think they'd have a leg up on that. So, but I think that's it, unless you have anything else to add.
I mean, you know, let's be honest. We both almost always have more we could add, but I think it covers. You're basically, I just want to say, it's possible that the heroes of Ilun have nothing to do with Ilun. It's possible they do. I don't know. I've always wanted to know why it's a bunch of stuff from a bunch of Titans and then Ilun. That's always been interesting, too, but I don't know.
Yep. So I think that's going to do it, though, for us today. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for you, the listener, Blizzard Watch of Blizzard Watch, Audible is offering free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You can actually use this is a wonderful opportunity to catch up on Illidan or Shadows Rising to learn more about some of the questions and answers that we provided earlier today. You can download many of Blizzard's titles as well as thousands of other books and titles at blizzardwatch.com/audible. And again, if you do have questions for us in the future, be sure to send them in to us. We do have the several Discord channels set aside specifically for this. Please be sure to send them in to us, either the podcast patron in queue question or the regular question one, or send them in via email at podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Thank you very, very much, and we'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.